Well, good morning, everybody. This is Lenny Lawson, the car guru, talking about hiring people. Does anybody out there need a job right now? You know, I guess probably a lot of the people that listen to this radio show are no longer working because they are retired and they can be home at this time of the morning. But there's others that are on the road, maybe, or listening from work. You probably should not be doing that. I'll be glad to write you an excuse. No, really. We have been looking for people for some time. You know, what should somebody be able to make in the car business if you are talented in the particular field that we are talking about? Every car dealership operates in a minimum of four, but maybe five businesses: a new car sales, used car sales, a finance department, a parts department, a service department, and some of them have a collision department or body shop. There may be a car rental agency involved. They may be operating a car wash. It could be any number of different what we call profit centers. And sometimes they are not profit centers. They are actually loss centers. But you have to operate them in order to complement another aspect of your business. But where do you find people and what should you pay them? Now, I realize that the minimum wage is $7 and a quarter, and I do believe that that is too low, and I don't think that many people get paid $7 and a quarter an hour anymore. If you were to check, do some type of a research, and at least in East Tennessee, I would say the average wage is well over $10 an hour. I may be wrong, but I don't really have any method of figuring that out. I'm sure the Bureau of Labor Statistics probably has that information, but I'm not privy to it. In the car business, there are different departments that a person can work in. I'd say the typical salesperson in East Tennessee, if they've been with the dealership a while, is going to make in the $50,000 to $75,000 a year range. I mean, there are some salespeople in East Tennessee that make $150,000, $200,000 a year. Not many, but they're out there. You know what makes them be able to do that, don't you? They're highly motivated, and they know how to take care of their customers. But most important of all is they do not rely on the dealership's advertising to bring them customers. They survive off of repeat and referral business. There are some people that get into the business and do really well for a short period of time and take a lot of shortcuts and lie and cheat and steal. But they typically don't last. They get found out. And either the dealership, that the people who own the dealership realize that this person is an outlaw and they get rid of them themselves, or, you know, they just don't last because of their lifestyle and the habits that they have. So anyway, you can make good money selling cars. As far as the service department is concerned, a good master technician should make in the mid-70s to even $100,000 a year. I mean, and over that, especially in Knoxville. Wages in Upper East Tennessee are not what they are in Knoxville. Do you realize that? People in Knoxville make more money. I don't understand why, because we're relatively close, but that's a fact. Maybe not in other areas, but in the car industry, it's a fact. Office people, you know, typically the office manager is probably $100,000 a year potential, maybe more. On the low side, probably $50,000 to $60,000 a year. In the parts department, those are pretty skilled jobs. You may think that, well, anybody can work in a parts department. You just have to look things up on a computer, but you have to know what you're looking for. A technician comes up and says, I need this particular part. You have to know where to go to find that particular part, and also what else you have to order in order to install that particular part. It's way more complicated than that. That's an oversimplification, but those people make in the 50-plus range in East Tennessee. What else? A good body tech can make $100,000 a year. Most of them don't. Most of them are in the $40,000 to $50,000 a year, but still, a good body tech, especially a painter. Painters can really rake it in. And it's a highly skilled position. and they everything's pretty much ready when it comes to them, and they can process work much faster than what the job actually pays in terms of flat rate. We've talked about on this radio show what flat rate is, and that's a, you know, it is a guide number. For example, maybe a front-end alignment pays an hour and a half flat rate time. It may take a tech 30 minutes to do it, or it may take him 3 hours to do it, but he still gets paid an hour and a half. That's out of a what they call a labor time guide. And really, it's fair to the consumer. You may go to a dealership or a repair shop and ask them, you know, what's it going to cost to have my brakes redone? Well, they can hit you with an accurate number. And so, you know, because they know what the parts are going to be and they know what the labor time guide says to charge for a front brake job or rear brake job. And so they understand, you know, what that is and can give you a quote. If it takes them less time, they still get paid. That's called beating the clock. And that's good for them. You shouldn't give them a hard time because it doesn't take them as long as what, you know, take as long to do the job as they get paid for the job in terms of hours, because that is their skill that has been honed to be able to beat the clock and make more money. That's how you have a technician that, you know, maybe a starting technician or makes $30,000 a year, whereas an experienced guy makes $75,000 to $100,000 a year. It's because they have learned shortcuts, and they have learned not bad shortcuts, but good shortcuts, ways to speed up the time. There was a day when we used to have to install air conditioners in a lot of our Mazdas when we were a Mazda dealer, and cars would come in from the factory, and very few of them had air conditioning. So Mazda and other makers made an air conditioning kit, which included a compressor and a condenser and all that stuff that goes into it. And we had a technician, the first one that he installed, I think he was putting it in a Mazda truck. It took him like 9 hours to do it. He got to the point, and basically the job only paid 5 hours. He got to the point where he could do it in 2.5 hours. So 2.5 versus 5, he could actually do two of those installations, and in the time that it used to take him to do just one. That's how they make more money. So don't begrudge the time. Typically, though, it takes longer, doesn't it? You know, a lot of these jobs are very complicated. The skill set that's necessary to be able to work on modern vehicles is really skewing towards more highly technological skill set in terms of computers and electronics. And that's changing the type of people that we can hire. You know, you can't just be a guy that used to work on lawnmower engines and graduated to, you know, 4x4s and side-by-sides and motorcycles and then on up to passenger cars and just be able to get by. You know, you've got to have really good comprehension skills. You've got to be very organized. You've got to be able to operate a computer. And you got to be able to get away and go to all these training schools. You know, that's a limitation for a lot of our technicians, is their lifestyle just does not accommodate that. And they're not able to travel. I've got so many technicians that have worked for me over the years, never flown on an airplane and scared to death and won't do it. And some of the schools that, you know, that they have to go to are out west, and that presents a problem. So anyway, that's kind of a brief summary of what auto jobs are like in East Tennessee. If you work at a factory or something like that that makes auto parts, it's a different world than we are. You may be making something that goes into our cars, but you're not doing what we do. I'd love to see somebody come from the factory and say, well, you know, I'd like to be able to turn wrenches on cars, because they had a lot of experience doing that growing up, and they just burn out so fast because they, I don't like it. But I mean, what I'm saying is that it's interesting to see people who think that they can either sell cars or work in a parts department or work in a car dealership, maybe as a service advisor or something, and they come and try it and they realize how stressful it is and how difficult it is. And I respect those people greatly who can do those jobs. I respect anybody that can do anything really well, you know. Well, maybe not criminals, but if they can do their job well, you know, a doctor, for example, who has not only great surgical skills or whatever, but he has a great bedside manner Everybody doesn't have all the different tools in their bag. But people who are, you know, the guy that I want operating on me is the guy that's done it a bunch of times and has a really good track record. Don't you? Don't give me the rookie. Let the rookie, you know, keep learning. So anyway, you know, it is a good industry, and it's something that, you know, we use Indeed. You've probably seen that a lot of the advertisements for Indeed. Those are the place where you go to hire people. And the vast majority of candidates that we speak to are ill-equipped to apply for a job, let alone do the job. They don't know how to present themselves. They don't know how to dress. They don't know how to speak. So many of the educators, I don't know whether, you know, sometimes I think the parents are the most important educators around, and they drop the ball. We all have at some point or another with our kids. But, you know, just teaching people manners, common courtesies, you know, how to look somebody in the eye when you're talking to them. So many people that I see, especially young people now, that just don't have those skills. They don't understand what dressing up is. Dressing up to them is, you know, a set of blue jeans with fewer holes in it. You know, it's just crazy. But anyway, I could whine about that all day. We'll be back in just a minute. So I bought a 65 Mustang convertible the other day from a radio show listener. And the car is not running. It runs, but it doesn't run well at all. So one of the first things we had to do was drain the gas tank. The fuel system, you know, is one of the first things that you have to address when you have a car that's not running. There's a lot of other things that you have to make sure of, you know, not the least of which is the coolant, you know, the situation with the antifreeze, whether it's getting spark or not, you know, just how overall the engine, the appearance and oil leaks and all that kind of stuff have to be addressed as well. But first we have to make sure that it's getting fuel. And so that has been a big deal over the years, especially as fuels have changed. You know, gasoline is probably the substance that inspires the strongest opinions when it comes to hobbyists, people who collect cars. Refinery technology has changed a lot since the car was first introduced. I mean, you wouldn't even recognize gasoline around 1900 versus what we have today. There was another really big change in formulations back in the 40s. Even in the 60s, when they started using premium blended fuels, modern fuels, though, are completely different. And it's really tough to decide what to put in your old car, you know, your vintage car like this Mustang. Being an educated consumer of gasoline, though, is basically you have to understand the facts versus the fiction. A lot of people think all they have to do is just go put high test in their old car. And because of all the different additives that are in gasoline, you could potentially do more harm than good by putting a very high octane fuel. You know, liquid gasoline, I don't know if you know this or not, but it doesn't really want to burn. What really ignites on fuel on gasoline are the fumes. It has to be in a vapor form to really ignite properly. Now, modern gasolines, especially the winter blends, are designed to be more volatile and will thus turn to vapor even more easily. In other words, they have higher vapor pressure. That tendency toward vaporization means easier cold starts, but it can also mean an easier vapor lock. Now, this is something which occurs when, you know, the fuel vaporizes before it gets to the cylinder, or the combustion chamber. It vaporizes in the line. And vaporization is good when you want to burn fuel, but it's bad when you want to move fuel through a fuel line. Vapor lock basically stops the fuel from pumping. And now hot weather or hot running engines exacerbate this problem. Modern vehicles use tank-mounted fuel pumps to push the gas to the engine, which maintains pressure in the lines. In older cars, however, the fuel pump was drawing gasoline from the front of the car near the engine from the tank that's mounted in the rear. And so this created problems of vapor lock. Your car won't start. That's basically what happens. Have you ever been climbing a hill in a car and you're going uphill, up a grade, and you put your foot on the gas and you hear kind of a knocking noise? Well, that's called pre-detonation. Now, the octane ratings of motor fuel are determined by running that fuel in a test engine where they can modify the compression, and they measure the resistance of that fuel to knocking, or that pre-detonation. Octane has nothing to do with the amount of potential energy in a fuel, only how much it can be squeezed before it will explode on its own. Now, high compression ratios and forced induction squeeze the air-fuel mixture more to obtain better efficiency and power. Now, this would be like a lot of your higher-end cars, like Porsches and BMWs, but even some Cadillacs and Lincolns and cars like that will have high compression engines and require premium fuel because of the high octane. Now, if that fuel ignites, is injected into the cylinder, if it ignites due to compression before there's a spark, then you're wasting power, you're hearing that knocking noise, and you can damage your engine. Electronic sensors along with ultra-precise ignition and valve timing permit modern engines, which typically run rather high compression ratios, to safely run on lower octane fuels. Now, sometimes this will sacrifice mid-range torque, but it gets that top speed and power that a lot of people are interested in. Now, on older vehicles with high compression engines or that call for higher octane, you don't need to skimp at the pump. A few more cents per gallon could save you from expensive engine repairs. So, you know, one of the things we have to be aware of, too, is ethanol. Now, ethanol is likely to remain on the scene for as long as most cars continue to use internal combustion engines. Older cars that are still on the road will degrade if they're exposed to ethanol. The degraded fuel line materials end up going downstream, causing issues with other equipment, like the small passages in carburetors. Some of you may not even know what a carburetor is because you're young. You've never been exposed to carburetors because everything has fuel injection now. But some owners of older cars will make some modifications to compensate for the different energy density of ethanol that is common in modern gasoline. Even a car owner who makes it a habit to seek out non-ethanol gas, like I always go to Marathon because they sell non-ethanol fuel for my lawnmowers and things like that, because I've got one, I have an X-Mark, it's a zero-turn mower, and it absolutely forbids you to use any fuel with ethanol. They make it very clear. And it's because of a couple attributes of ethanol, one of which is that it suffers from something called phase separation over time, where the lighter elements separate from the heavier elements, leaving two different octanes layered on top of one another. Now, vehicles that are going to be stored, such as collector cars, but even, like I say, boats or lawn tractors, should be either drained of fuel or treated with something called a fuel stabilizer. Ethanol is also hygroscopic, which means that it will absorb moisture from the air. So water in fuel lines causes corrosion. It can freeze, and it certainly won't burn in the engine. Stabilizers are a proactive way to keep fuel fresh for up to 24 months, and water removers can deal with tanks of fuel that have already absorbed too much moisture. So it's very critical what you put in your car as far as gasoline, less so with new vehicles. Just follow the owner's manual and do what it says. Don't burn high-octane fuel in cars that don't call for it. Don't burn low-octane fuel in cars that call for high-octane fuel, or you can actually damage your engine. So, and then when older cars, don't use anything with ethanol in it, and you should be good to go. We'll be back in just a minute. Okay, we're back. You know, one other thing you need to be concerned about is just maintaining proper fluid levels and using a high-quality oil. What kind of oil are you putting in your car? Well, if you haven't opened up your owner's manual and read it, then go to the oil section and see what they recommend, and that's what you need to use. The weight of the oil is very important. You know, whether it's zero weight oil or 10W30 or whatever they recommend, that's what you need to use. There's this thing called thermal breakdown, and it's one of the most damaging things that can happen to your engine. It occurs when basically the internal heat, the vehicle gets hot, you know, it causes a chemical reaction in the motor oil. And it causes the oil's viscosity or thickness to change. Basically, if the engine heats up beyond a certain temperature, the motor oil will start to degrade, and that's what thermal breakdown is all about. And what it can do is it can lead to total engine failure, catastrophic engine failure, which means that you need a new engine or a new used engine. And just servicing your vehicle every, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 miles, if you're using maybe a synthetic oil, some of them say, well, you can go 15,000 miles without an oil change. Well, you better make sure you're checking your oil, because that's a long time to go without an oil change, and I absolutely do not recommend that. Seventy-five hundred miles would be my limit as far as an oil change. But I just change my oil every 5,000 miles. It's easy to remember, and I get my tires rotated every time, and that will make all the difference in the world for the life of your tires and also for the health of your engine. Well, that's the end of the show, and we will see you tomorrow on the next edition of My Car Guru.